in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a guest that I think you're all going to look forward to hearing. He is the author of a very controversial and provocative new book. In fact, maybe one of the most provocative books in years. Mark Crispin Miller will be our guest today, talking about his new book, Fooled Again: How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too. So please join us today, live, for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On November 15th, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting finally released a report from its Inspector General detailing the unethical behavior of former CPB Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson. The report was delivered to CPB more than 2 weeks ago. Shortly after its existence became public, Tomlinson resigned. Now we know why. In addition to launching a crusade to find and silence so-called liberal bias on PBS and NPR, Tomlinson actively schemed to get the Wall Street Journal its own TV show and threatened to cut off funding to PBS if the network didn't add more right-leaning programs. What's more, those hired under Tomlinson's watch had to pass a political litmus test, and existing CPB staffers were quizzed about their party affiliations and campaign contributions. According to Free Press campaign director Timothy Carr, this behavior most definitely broke the law.
The report found that Tomlinson indeed violated the Public Broadcasting Act, but there is no avenue, and they don't recommend any avenue for punishment.
Yet the full story has not yet been told. Tomlinson worked very closely with senior officials in the White House on the crusade to conservatively politicize public broadcasting, but that information, says Carr, is still missing in action.
We know that there is another report that was submitted to the CPB that the CPB has in their hands that has not been made public.
It may take an act of Congress to pry this mystery report loose. Meanwhile, calls for wholesale reform of the public broadcast system are gaining momentum, but it remains to be seen whether the political will exists to force meaningful change.
Sinclair Broadcasting does not take dissent lightly, especially from former employees. One of the company's star reporters got fired last year after he spoke out against Sinclair's decision to air a documentary that smeared John Kerry right before the election. Now the company has filed a lawsuit against Jonathan Lieberman seeking $17,000 in damages for allegedly violating the terms of his contract. According to the filing, Lieberman's public dismay about Sinclair's penchant to present, quote, biased propaganda constituted a divulging of confidential and proprietary information about corporate operations. The Society of Professional Journalists has condemned the court action as something that smells like an effort to punish a whistleblower.
Sony BMG gets caught selling copy-protected CDs which contain code that make computers running Windows vulnerable to malicious exploit. Several dozen Sony BMG music releases contain digital rights management software to prevent excessive copying, which gets installed when users insert the CD and use the onboard music player to listen to it. The problem is, the software contains code which allows it to hide its files from public view. This raises the troubling possibility that a hacker could exploit this code to seed machines with something damaging without a user's knowledge or consent. It's been estimated that more than 500,000 computer networks around the world contain at least one computer that's been compromised in this fashion. Sony BMG has since released a patch to uncloak the hidden files its copy-protected CDs leave on hard drives, but the company refuses to provide information on how to safely uninstall the software itself. What's worse, Sony BMG's program tampers with core functions of the Windows operating system, and improperly uninstalling the program can cause Windows itself to crash. Further digging into this story uncovered even more delicious irony, like the fact that many Sony BMG CDs contain a second program which transmits information from your computer to a server every time you play a copy-protected CD. And to top it all off, those who wrote Sony's copy protection software apparently pilfered open-source code in the process, which conceivably constitutes a violation of copyright law.
Next year's midterm elections could be the most expensive ever in terms of spending on political advertising. Projections call for $1.5 billion worth of ads. Last year's election cycle set a new record at $1.7 billion. More than a dozen candidates running for office next year have already started airing spots. The heaviest political spending will most likely take place in the states of California, Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, New York, and Texas.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Don't like telemarketers? Sign up for the FCC's National Do Not Call Registry. But is it really effective? 51% of respondents recently surveyed about the registry say no. They still get calls they expected would be blocked. The Federal Trade Commission reports it still receives between 1 and 2,000 complaints a day about telemarketers. Even so, since the National Do Not Call Registry went online in 2003, only 6 fines have been levied against telemarketers who've ignored it. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live November 20, 2005 from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in lovely and beautiful Urbana, Illinois on a spectacular late autumn Sunday afternoon. Today we have a guest that we've been wanting to get on the air for months now. We've been awaiting the release, the publication of his brand new book. Our guest is Mark Crispin Miller, a professor of media studies at New York University, the author of numerous books, including The Bush Dyslexicon and Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. He has a brand new book out that we're going to be talking about today, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Bob.
It's a real pleasure to have you, Mark. And I want to say, as our listeners are about to learn, this is a book that pulls no punches, that really goes for the jugular, so to speak, about what happened in the 2004 election. And first, you know, why bother looking at the 2004 election? What is it about it that makes you think it's worthy of a book?
Yeah, well, my aim is certainly not to try to challenge the outcome, because there's no constitutional way to do that, and, you know, no reasonable political way to do it, even if it could be proven in a court of law or in the well of the Senate that the Republicans stole the election. Nothing in the Constitution would guide us here. And even if there were some way to make, say, John Kerry the president belatedly, I don't think that would be such a hot idea, since he conceded so quickly and let down all those people who voted for him. My aim is not to fiddle with the past. My aim is rather to jumpstart a national movement of electoral reform as soon as possible, because if we don't pay attention to what went down last year, if we don't stop denying the obvious, if we don't finally take a look at the abundant, glaring evidence of widespread fraud by the Bush regime, the same interests that engineered that theft will engineer thefts in all our future elections, and American democracy will be only a memory. In fact, one could argue that it is now only a memory. But as egregious as last year's fraud was, there are, you know, every week new steps taken to try to nail down another national victory for what is essentially a fringe minority group, the theocratic right. So I am insisting that we do whatever we can do to get the story of last year's election onto the national radar screen where it belongs.
And you argue in this book, Mark Crispin Miller, that John Kerry, in fact, was the legitimate winner of the 2004 election. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my contention. I don't have an exact count of how many votes he got, but I am convinced that there are many reasonable ways to make a solid, rough estimate. The fact is that Bush's ostensible victory is a statistical impossibility. Here we have a guy who has disapproval ratings in the high 40s, highest disapproval ratings of any incumbent running for re-election since they started measuring this sort of thing.
So if I can interrupt you here, Mark Miller. So this is higher, say, than George Bush the first had in 1992 or higher than Jimmy Carter had in 1980?
Yes.
And both of them, of course, lost quite dramatically.
They lost quite dramatically. And let's add to this the fact that that Bush was actually presiding over a divided party. I devote several pages in Fooled Again to the abundant evidence that, that the Republican Party was actually quite divided last year. And this is evident, you know, through many different data. For example, a lot of top Republicans came out with very strong anti-Bush statements during the campaign season, like Bob Barr. I mean, who's more right-wing than Bob Barr? It was one of Clinton's biggest nemeses during the whole Clinton impeachment fiasco. Bob Barr is now a consultant to the ACLU, which is not to say he's any further to the left than he used to be, but he wrote a very powerful piece against Bush on three grounds: his threat to civil liberties, his reckless spending, and his warlike foreign policy. But there was also John Eisenhower, Dwight's son and a lifelong Republican, wrote a ringing endorsement of John Kerry. General Tony McPeak, the Air Force, who'd been a military man for Bush in 2000, was now supporting Kerry. Lee Iacocca, Tom Clancy. And then there were, for example, open letters written by various conservative groups. There were 169 tenured and emeritus business professors who signed an open letter to Bush excoriating his economic policies. And in fact, the letter originated at the Harvard Business School, where you-know-who got his MBA. There was a lot of propaganda of that kind, and the mainstream press would never mention it. But there was nothing comparable on the other side.
Now, let me ask you something, Mark, about that. We're going to get into this a lot more, Mark Miller, but you say the mainstream press never covered this.
That's right.
Now, I mean, it's not like this was a position that favored, say, the Socialist Worker Party or the Libertarian Party or the Green Party. This is actually something of great value to the other main political party in the United States, the Democrats.
Yeah, right.
Why would working journalists or major corporate media, news media, and public media, PBS and NPR for that matter, carry water for the Republican, for the Bush administration in this way when there's significant Republican dissension? Why isn't that a news story, and why aren't Democrats pushing this as a news story?
Well, you tell me, Bob. The Democrats have taken the Republican line on this. Now, there are exceptions. Okay, I'm not talking about John Conyers here. But the National Democrats have been completely wedded to the Republican line on this election from the beginning. The Republican line from the beginning was there's no evidence of fraud. This is what all the Republicans said during the House debate on January 6th of this year when they were debating over the Conyers report, the occasion being the challenge to the electoral vote count in Ohio. Well, Conyers' people had collected copious evidence, solid evidence, not speculation, not allegation, but evidence of all kinds of fraud committed in Ohio in last year's election. And yet the Republicans had the sort of frightening brazenness to say outright that there was no evidence, and they never addressed the evidence. They just kept denying there was any. Well, now we find that John Kerry, for example, has consistently taken the same position in public. I don't know. Did you hear about my little encounter with Kerry a few weeks ago?
Well, why don't you? Well, let me reintroduce you to our listeners so they know what they're listening to, and then you can recount the story for us. You're listening to Mark Crispin Miller today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Crispin Miller is the author of the brand new book just released from Basic Books, Fooled Again: How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One Too Unless We Stop Them. This book, having read it over the past few days, for those of you unfamiliar with Mark Crispin Miller's previous books, is exquisitely well written, a pleasure to read, and as provocative as any political book you could possibly read in years. So go ahead, Mark Miller. Tell us about your encounter with John Kerry.
My encounter with Kerry. Well, about 3 weeks ago, this would be on October 28th, I got myself invited to a fundraiser for Kerry's Political Action Committee. Someone very close to Kerry shares my concern about the state of our electoral democracy and wanted me to give Kerry a copy of my book and discuss the issue with him. so we met a very nice house in Chelsea here in the city. I got to go to the cocktail party before the dinner. These are very, very rich liberals. And in came Kerry. I had the book in my hand. I said to him, "You were robbed, Senator." And he said, "I know." And he kind of clutched his head in a gesture of frustration. And he went on about the fact that none of his colleagues on the Hill will talk to him about this. He told me he had just had a big argument with Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, trying to tell Dodd that the voting machines are really problematic and not to be trusted. And Dodd, he said, didn't want to hear it. He got kind of angry. He said, you know, "We looked into this. There's no story there." This was Kerry's way of saying to me, you know, "I hope you have a lot of evidence because this is what I'm up against." So I told him that the book is filled with evidence. I also mentioned the GAO report, Government Accountability Office report, that had come out the week before about the weaknesses in the touchscreen voting machines, a very important document, which, again, the press did not report at all. And to my surprise, let me mention this parenthetically, Kerry had not heard about it. He didn't know it had come out. What I wanted to say to him was, "What is your staff in a coma?" You know, but I didn't. It wouldn't have been politic. But he was very impressed that the GAO had done this and obviously filed it away mentally. So I said, "Look, Senator, I think that in the spirit of your groundbreaking investigations of Iran-Contra and BCCI, which I actually do consider his finest work in the Senate, I think you should look into last year's election with a particular emphasis on the current state of our electoral system." And he said, "Well, I don't know if I can be the one to do that because of the sour grapes factor." And I said, "I understood that. I mean, that makes sense to me. But I was still hoping that he might find the evidence so powerful that he would find a way to bring this up." So we parted on very good terms, kind of punched me on the arm, gave me the thumbs up, you know. So I was really, to be perfectly candid, I was exhilarated by this. I thought, you know, this is progress because we've got to get people like him to discuss this in the public arena. Well, my book tour started about 4 days later here in New York, and I took to telling the story in my bookstore appearances. Then I was on Democracy Now, and I told the story there. I was debating with Mark Hertzgaard, who had written what I consider to be a very feeble piece in Mother Jones, actually trying to disprove that there was any fraud last year. And I noticed in this debate that Hertzgaard kept quoting Democrats as if that was somehow decisive. He said, "Well, a Democrat told me that this was innocent," or "a Democrat told me this was not a problem." So I figured, well, I know about a Democrat who feels a particular way. Let's see if this counts. So I told the story. I said, "Kerry told me the other night that he now believes the election was stolen." Hertzgaard was staggered. He was, in fact, quite impressed by this. He said, "This is major news. You really buried the lead here, et cetera." Later that day, Democracy Now! Sent out a press release, a breaking story, "Kerry now thinks the vote was stolen." And then a few hours later, Kerry's office released a statement categorically denying he had had this conversation with me and intimating that I made it up to sell the book and saying the only true thing I had said was that I gave him the book. Like I gave it to him as a process server would give somebody a summons and fled, you know. Let me just say.
Yeah, please do.
The next day, the journalist Robert Perry, who is an exemplary reporter, had a piece on his website, Consortium News, revealing that another associate of Kerry's, a guy named Jonathan Weiner, had also told him, "Yes, John Kerry has told me he thinks the election was stolen." So there's no doubt that Kerry believes this. The frightening thing is that here Kerry had been complaining about Democratic denial and then immediately did the same thing, when confronted with my story.
Now, your book, Mark Crystal Miller, goes into considerable detail to support your claim that the election was stolen. And we'll talk a little bit about that during the show. But again, we can't go through all of it.
Right.
Of course, there are people who have to look at the book. But I do think the point you're touching on right now, what would happen to John Kerry or any prominent Democrat And I think Kerry would be the most striking, but Edwards would similarly, or Hillary Clinton, or Bill Clinton, if they were to come out and begin to insist the election actually was stolen, what sort of response do you think they would get currently from the news media and from what looks like their fellow Democrats?
Oh, they would be ridiculed. They would be ridiculed mercilessly and pressured and accused of sour grapes and paranoia and conspiracies. They'd be compared to Michael Moore, you know, which seems to be the worst insult anyone can come up with. Although, ironically, Michael Moore doesn't think it was stolen. The fact is, the whole system is built to accommodate or to echo the Republican line on this whole story. You know, as I said, from the beginning, the Republicans have had talking points attacking those who dare to suggest that the election was illegitimate. These talking points include no substantive arguments, no counterarguments, no intelligent dissent, just attacks, just ridicule. And the press, the corporate press, was doing this almost immediately after Election Day. I talk about this in Fooled Again, that just shortly after Election Day, suddenly there were stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, which was the first to come out with one, basically mocking people who had the crazy idea that there was something fishy about the election results. This is a very interesting problem, and you know, I'd be more than happy to discuss it with you here at some length. You know, what is the reason for this? What are the rational explanations for this strange silence on a story that would sell a lot of newspapers, would certainly boost ratings on the networks, and that actually serves the self-interest of the Democrats? And I think the answer is that in part, a lot of Democrats are just as corrupt as Republicans. A lot of Democrats are, for all intents and purposes, Republicans. So in places like rural Ohio, for example, where the boards of elections are supposedly bipartisan, that means very little, because rural Democrats in Ohio are you know, inseparable from the other party. I think there's also a very strong element of denial. This is a very frightening story. The implications are shattering. And so it's a lot easier, especially for establishment figures, both in the press and in the political system, to simply laugh it off, to say, there's nothing there, this is crazy, you know, I don't want to go there. And what particularly strikes me about the last few weeks is that so many progressive and liberal pundits have taken the same line. I mean, I mentioned Mark Hertzgaard, who is actually an old friend of mine, in Mother Jones, trying to debunk the notion that the election was stolen. Just the other day in Salon, Farhad Manjoo, whose work I quote extensively in my book, and whom I thank in my acknowledgments because he did such good work on this problem before the election, he wrote an absolutely blistering review of Fooled Again, a wild tissue of exaggerations and you know, self-deceptions, I guess. But the man was furious. He was furious at the fact that I'd written the book and dared to say that this may have happened. So this strange kind of super cautiousness, this shying away from unpleasant realities, this is not just a moderate or right-wing problem. This is an establishment problem. The whole political establishment, left to right, is in denial on this thing. That may sound crazy, but I appeal to you, Bob. You've read my book. You know that it's well-sourced. It's thoroughly documented. And there's really no rational way to justify Bush's victory. I mean, there is no credible way to explain how he got over 11 million more votes in 2004 than he got in 2000. It makes no sense whatsoever. But it's too big, it's too scary, and people just simply don't want to admit that it can happen here.
You're listening to Mark Crispin Miller, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so please call in if you have any questions. Our phone lines are open. The number is 333-9455, 333-9455, and the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mark Miller is the author of many books and has the brand-new book out, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. And Mark Miller, you started at the beginning of the show talking about some of the empirical evidence that Bush could not have won the 2004 election.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about the disapproval ratings for the President Bush, which were historically higher than they'd ever been for a first-term president going into a election for as long as we've held them. Some of the other data you talk about at some length, which I think is certainly the data that gets a lot of statisticians' attention, is exit polling data. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that's a huge story, and I do talk about it in the book. I don't talk about it in as much detail as I would have liked for the simple reason that the exit poll anomaly, precisely because it is so explosive, has for the last year been the object of a lot of obfuscation and sort of special pleading by a lot of figures in the establishment. Therefore, in many people's minds, it's not decisive anymore. The waters have been muddied. So I did not want to rely any more heavily than I had to on that factor. Let me say quickly that there's a new book coming out by statistician Steve Freeman, which he co-wrote with the editor of In These Times, Joel Bleifuss, called Was the 2004 Election Stolen? It's coming from Seven Stories Press, and it will deal largely with the exit polls. So I think my book and his, you know, are complementary. Basically, in five swing states, Kerry was predicted to win fairly comfortably by the exit polls, and then in all five states, Bush won.
And let's explain what exit polls are for listeners maybe not familiar with that term. What is an exit poll?
Exit polls are these are basically pollsters positioned outside polling places asking people as they exit the polling places who they voted for. And those who have studied polling at all know that historically exit polls tend to be regarded as the gold standard of polling. Now, this is not, you know, there have been examples of exit polls that were mistaken. I don't mean to overstate this, but by and large, they tend to be quite reliable.
Well, to just sort of corroborate the point you're making, when the Carter Center studies elections around the world or when their elections are monitored in newly emerging democracies, exit polls are what are used to make sure there hasn't been a stolen election through chicanery with the ballot box.
That's exactly right. Now, it's really remarkable. I mean, you know, you think to yourself, well, saying that up is down and black is white, you know, that happens in 1984. It happens in the novel. Maybe it happens in totalitarian systems. It doesn't happen here, though. But the arguments that statisticians have come out with a straight face to explain the exit poll results away are really, they're awesome. And I have to say, they're just awesome. The kind of, you know, mental acrobatics they do. For example, Warren Matofsky is the guy who ran the exit polling operation for the media. The media paid for this, and let me add, by the way, that to this day, Matofsky has not released the raw data from his exit polls, the actual raw precinct-level data. The media has refused to yield it up so that independent scholars can look at it, and Matofsky has refused to give it up, which I think is extremely weird. At any rate, Matofsky's claim, here's what happened. The exit polls predicted a Kerry victory. Kerry lost in those five states. So everybody promptly turned around and concluded that the exit polls were mistaken because somehow the official numbers couldn't be wrong. So when he was trying to come up with an explanation for this weird glitch, Matofsky said that it was something called the reluctant responder thesis. He opined that Bush voters, being older on the whole, would tend to be more reluctant to respond frankly to young people bearing clipboards than other voters, so that you had this strange phenomenon of Republicans not coming across with the truth about who they voted for. Mark Hertzgard and Mother Jones finds this entirely credible. Well, you know, all you have to do is take a look at the refusal rates. I mean, there's a statistical way to tell if this is true or not. And in fact, the refusal rates among the exit pollsters were constant across all precincts, regardless of their partisan complexion. So it's just a fantasy. There was no reluctant responder tendency that was, you know, particularly marked on the right. That's just crazy.
Had this ever been a factor in earlier elections? Is this a new concept, the reluctant responder?
The reluctant responder, I think, is a new concept. The idea that the exit polls are off when it comes down to a judgment between them and the official tally, you choose the official tally. This started in 2000, which was, of course, the first time that Bush-Cheney stole the election. So let me expatiate on this for a moment. This helps us understand the kind of pathological dimension of this whole discussion. You know, the people who deny the evidence of fraud pose as hard-minded skeptics, you know, tough empiricists, paying attention only to the facts. Well, that's simply not the case. I mean, they're not looking at the facts. Here we have an administration that has stood accused of all manner of the most atrocious kind of misjudgment and malfeasance. And we accept that now. We buy the fact that they lied us into a horrific war. We accept that. We accept that they had ample forewarning of 9/11 but did nothing. I mean, we like to say it was the result of ineptitude, but we grant that that happened. We grant that they were criminally negligent after Katrina and Rita, and we grant that they're now gouging the taxpayers and cheating the victims of that catastrophe by coming up with all this pork for the likes of Halliburton. I mean, they do one horrific thing after another. We have no problem accepting it. We also know they're sucking up to the Chinese government. We know that they banished Haiti's first democratically elected government in its history. They just sashayed into the country and threw the president out. We know all this. And yet somehow we're having a hard time believing that they would steal an election here. I mean, this is just insane. These are Richard Nixon's spiritual children. Of course they would steal an election. And they have to steal elections because their agenda is extreme. Their agenda is way, way off the charts. This is why Bush has strong support approval ratings of something like 22% now, and that's with a margin of error of 4 points. This is the same proportion of the American people who liked the way Bush and the Congress handled the Terry Schiavo case. There's about a fifth of the electorate that is theocratically inclined, that is interested in biblical law, that thinks Bush and God are real close friends. You know, that doesn't make for anything close to a majority. This party, as it's now configured, has to steal elections, has to dominate the media, because there's no other way they can prevail politically.
We're talking to Mark Crispin Miller today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Miller is the author of the brand new book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One Too Unless We Stop Them. Just come out from Basic Books. Mark Miller is on a book tour this month, and he's graciously taken time to speak with us today on Media Matters. Our phone lines are full, Mark Miller, you'll be glad to know.
Good.
Let's go right to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, thanks for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, the phone lines are full, but I've got a couple questions, if it's all right. First, I'd like to know, I remember on Election Day, there were exit polls coming out, and Karl Rove is reported to have said, I think this was for Ohio, Karl Rove is reported to have said, that's wrong, and he got on the phone to somebody, and all of a sudden, the poll numbers changed. Okay, that's the first question. The second question is, it seems to me that if, in fact, you're right about this, this has some tremendous implications on the Democrats' strategy. That is to say, they shouldn't be trying to appeal to the religious right. They should be trying to fix this problem of stolen elections.
That's amen. Well, in answer to the first question, it's quite simple. Yes, I've read that story, too, and it sounds like Rove, so I believe it did happen. Secondly, and I think more importantly, You hit this one right out of the park. The fact is, the Democrats are responding to a phantom majority. You know, there is no such thing as a large plurality of Americans for whom gay marriage is the leading issue. I mean, I deal with the statistics in my book, but this is a propaganda myth promulgated by the religious right to give itself a lot of credit in the eyes of the political establishment, and the Democrats have fallen for it. From my travels, from my appearances on talk radio, and sometimes I go on talk radio in places like Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is about as right wing as you can get. I've done conservative shows. I'm telling you that this regime is profoundly unpopular across the country. The Democrats are behaving with a kind of shocking cravenness and lack of patriotism in their refusal to stand up for the system that the framers built for us. That's what's at stake here. You know, the right to vote is the linchpin of all our freedoms. It is central to the preservation of the American Republic, and a lot of Americans, the vast majority, conservative and liberal alike, understand this. So the Democrats really got to get their act together. They got to start breathing some real air in this country and not just the air inside the Beltway.
Mark Miller, let me mention a couple of anecdotes before we return to our patient callers. I spoke with a friend of mine who's a member of Congress from Ohio, a Democrat, a very leading Democrat and highly respected. And the day or so before the election in 2004, he'd been doing a lot of work for Kerry on the ground in Ohio. He was absolutely convinced the Democrats were going to carry the state because of the work they had done. Compared to previous years, he'd worked in every presidential election in Ohio since the 60s. He said, this is a slam dunk. We've got it locked up. And I think, you know, that was certainly the impression people I heard from Ohio until late on Tuesday afternoon on Election Day. There was tremendous confidence.
That's right.
And then the other – so that sort of supports your, I think, argument. Then I spoke with him just a couple of weeks ago. And he said to me, he knows that a significant number of votes were stolen. There's a lot of truth in this. But he says he just can't believe that they could steal. What was the difference in Ohio?
118,000.
He just couldn't believe it was that many, though. He said, I just can't believe they could have gone that far. I mean, it was too far apart to be stolen. He said,
that's,
you've probably heard that before.
Oh, sure, sure. You know, the Democratic strategy, just to get back to the previous caller, seems to be based on the assumption that if you win big enough, you can override the cheaters. Now, I suppose if your poll numbers show you with a 70% lead, something like that, that's feasible. But we have to understand that, you know, if you're going to cheat, and you're going to cheat big, if you're going to do this in a serious way, if you're going to base your entire electoral strategy on a whole broad range of disenfranchising tactics and vote destroying tactics, you can override a fairly healthy gap. 118,000 votes is not that much when you consider the extent of the anti-democratic activity that went on, especially in all the cities in Ohio. You know, in all the cities in Ohio, the population, of course, trended blue. But if you just, you know, open your eyes to the amazing range of tricks played from top to bottom by Ken Blackwell, you know, from the early days of the campaign all the way through the recount, which never happened, when you realize that some 100,000 votes in Ohio have still not been counted. 118,000 votes just doesn't seem like that much. I mean, your friend sounds like he's got integrity, like he's smart and he's honest. But, you know, I think that what he's saying to you is that he does not want to believe that this can happen. But believe me, it can, and believe me, it did.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Ryan, Illinois. You're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi. Great topic. Okay, where do you start? On this program, Howard Zinn mentioned a possible people's tribunal to begin with an impeachment hearing. Any new dyslexicon additions? I heard the word Islamofascist recently in a speech. And also, could you talk about the maybe backdoor programs or something about the electronic voting machines, if you know something about those? One other point is you used the word egregious decisions, and I think that's an important fact, important point. These aren't just mistakes. These are egregious decisions that they've made from day one. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, well, that's a lot of points.
Yeah, Mark, can I ask to sort of convert that to some extent to something that occurs to me and I think you talk about in your book? I mean, it seems like we have a thousand little things that add up to this. I mean, is there like one person who's sort of mapping a strategy that we know about?
I would imagine, and this is just speculation, I would imagine that Karl Rove was crucial to this whole enterprise. You know, when it comes to dealing with secretaries of state who are helping to steal the vote in their particular part of the country, you know, who are they going to deal with? Who are they going to talk to? Ken Blackwell in Ohio, Jan Brewer in Arizona, Mary Kiffmeyer in Minnesota, Glenda Hood in Florida. I mean, there was a certain amount of imitation. You know, the tactics from Florida were introduced into Ohio.
In all five of these states, the Secretary of State, which in every state is the person in charge of elections, was an elected Republican?
Yes. And in two of those cases, it was a chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in the state, which should be illegal, of course. That's one of the reforms we very badly need. But what I'm saying is that while there was a tremendous amount of freelance obstructionism, grassroots anti-democratic activism, and I talk about this in detail in the book, there also seems to me has to have been a fair amount of coordination. For one thing, these efforts cost a lot of money. In the book, I talk about the criminal activities of Sproul and Associates, which is a company that the Republican National Committee paid to conduct bogus registration drives in at least half a dozen states across the country. That cost the Republican National Committee, I discovered, over $8 million. Publicly, they claim to have spent only $3.5 million. In fact, they spent over $8 million. That makes it the eighth largest campaign expense they incurred. And I also discovered that when they filed with the FEC to account for their spending, they hid about half of that money by pretending that it was spent, you know, next year, things like that. So, you know, I believe that they used laundered money, just like Nixon did, to pull this stuff off. And in order to, you know, hire an outfit like Sproul to sort of systematically undo thousands upon thousands of Democratic voters, you can't just leave that to chance. It has to be managed to some extent. So I think this was at once a grassroots effort involving a lot of religious fanatics just sort of doing what they could do on the ground, and also a lot of top-down stuff that would have to be the work of Rove and his people.
We're talking to Mark Crispin-Miller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Crispin-Miller is the author of the brand-new book, just published by Basic Books, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. A book, as you can tell, about the stealing of the 2004 election, the role of the media in not covering this story then or subsequently. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Crispin-Miller.
Just a question and a comment. The question is, of the five states that you mentioned, were all of those states electronic voting machine states in key places? Is that like the primary means in each of these cases? You're mentioning a lot of other means, actually, by which this can be accomplished. I just wanted to know if the five each had like a diebold issue. And second, I find those specific instances far more convincing than saying disapproval ratings. I mean, leading up to the election, I know a lot of people who voted for Bush, though I'm a progressive myself, and you know, they might have been embarrassed about the incompetence, but had no problem with the, you know, overt racism, homophobia, recklessness, all of it. They didn't have a problem with this. So I find that less convincing than the specifics of, you know, how things were done. Anyway, it's mostly about the five states. That's my question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Mark, what were the five states for starters?
They were Ohio, Iowa, New Mexico, and my memory is now failing me.
Florida,
and that's right, and I forget the fifth. But it was the answer to the question is that they all used electronic touchscreen machines of some kind. They didn't all use Diebold. They didn't all use ESNS. But in you know, like for example, in New Mexico, some 17,000 voters in Democratic precincts could not register a presidential vote on the machines they used. And Bush supposedly won New Mexico by 7,000 votes. So, that, you know, right there is grounds for a serious investigation. In Iowa, Bush's victory was quite, you know, the margin was small. It was not even 5,000 votes. I think it was 4,508 votes or something like that. And I have examples in the book of deliberate attempts to disenfranchise disenfranchise college students, places like Iowa State and the University of Iowa. So, you know, you do enough of that stuff, you can certainly make a difference that's modest.
You know, I want you to talk about the voting machines in a second, but first, I think the question that logically jumps out is, okay, we know that there was some crazy stuff going on in these states where the Republicans were the secretaries of state. Were Democrats doing similar stuff in states where they were secretaries of state? I mean, is this something that both sides just routinely do in their own states?
Well, the large answer to that question is that both sides have, throughout our history, routinely stolen votes. You know, election fraud is as American as apple pie, unfortunately. And this is the thesis of Andrew Gumbel's book, Steal This Vote, in which the historical chapters, I think, are excellent. And I'm from Chicago, so nobody has to tell me that Democrats steal votes. In fact, I've been struck this last year by how many of Mayor Daley's tactics, you know, Democratic tactics, were used by the right. The fact is that in the last couple of elections, the Democrats simply did not engage in any kind of systemic collective fraud. The kinds of fraud that they stand accused of, and this is true, you know, like you read what Rush Limbaugh has had to say and others, it's always what they call voter fraud. It's always at the individual level. It's, for example, people hired to register new voters. They get paid $4 a piece, so they make up the names of voters so they can get the money. That stuff goes on, but it pales into insignificance by contrast with the large-scale kind of activism that I describe in Fooled Again.
Ian, talk now, if you would. We don't have a lot of time. We have four callers queued up to speak with you. But before we go to them, Mark, back to this question of voting machines, Diebold. What role do these electronic machines play in this problem?
A huge role. The three largest companies that manufacture these touchscreen machines are all Republican-owned and managed. I mean, they have strong partisan ties. I document all this in the book. That's Diebold, ESNS, and Sequoia. But, you know, there's a profound problem even in the very notion of an electronic vote count, because what it amounts to, when you get right down to it, is a secret count. When you say, you know, trust us, our machines are accurate, trust us, we know what we're doing, you might as well hand the ballots to some guy who can take them home with him, come up with a count, and then come out and say, this is the number. It's simply wrong. You know, it's simply un-American.
What percentage of the votes in, say, Ohio, for example, were conducted on machines like that?
I can't tell you about Ohio per se. I can tell you that whether you're talking about the voting machines themselves or proprietary software made by those same companies to count paper ballots, that combined those elements together have been said to affect up to 80% of the votes cast in this country. In some 30 states, these machines have a tremendous amount of influence. So it's a serious, serious problem. And people talked about, you know, I think there's been far too much discussion of Ohio as if Ohio were the only place where this stuff went on. In something like 11 states across the country, there were reports of electronic voting machines systematically turning Kerry votes into Bush votes. It happened in Texas, it happened in Florida, it happened all over the place. I have not heard of any electronic machines turning Bush votes into Kerry votes.
Now, in fact, there was a very interesting article in Vanity Fair by a Bush supporter, Christopher Hitchens.
Yes, right.
Where he specifically said, it's very interesting, I've gone through all this stuff and I'm not hearing any credible explanations of chicanery that has cost Bush votes. It's all going one way, which, you know, arouses his suspicion, even as a Bush supporter.
That's right. I mean, that was a rare lucid interval for Christopher Hitchens.
Let's go back to the phone lines, try to get all these callers in.
Okay.
Line 3, Champagne, thanks for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller. Hello, line 3.
Yes, I have several observations and one question.
We don't have a whole lot of time,
well,
so if we
I've
could...
Well, I've waited a long time, but anyhow, your guest has spoken with lots of generalities and without substantiation. He's clearly very partisan and anti-Republican. He referred to exit polls do not reflect the outcome of the election, but I don't know of any exit polls that canvass absentee voters, particularly those in the military and their families. who could not stand John Kerry. Your guest mentioned, actually your guest is very, very vocal in stating anti-democratic actions by the Republicans in Ohio, but he fails to mention that the Democrats are doing precisely that now with the Republicans at this time. We get daily calls from those people. It is inconceivable to me, as an engineer, that a voting machine would be designed and not tested and proved before its acceptance for voting, where it was able to take votes given for one person and move it to somebody else. It's just not realistic.
Okay,
A conspiracy of the nature of what your guest talks about is too big to keep quiet. My question for your guest is, how far to the left of Leon Trotsky should he place himself?
All right, well, thank you for the, I think it might be what they call a rhetorical question mark.
That's a great question. Yeah, I guess if the truth is painful, anyone who articulates it must be an extreme leftist. An interesting view. Your guest doesn't know what he's, I mean, I'm your guest. Your caller is very, very uninformed, and I'm not partisan at all. I think that...
The one question he did mention that I think is of value that we haven't talked about is absentee voters. I mean,
yeah,
they're a significant part of the vote count in every state now. They're going to grow.
Right.
How does that factor into what you're doing?
The absentee ballots have historically been the most vulnerable to fraud. In fact, there was a Republican report issued by the Secretary of State in Florida making this very point. This is, you know, back in the late 90s. The last chapter of Fooled Again deals with the most important category of absentee ballots, and that's those votes cast by Americans living abroad. That was it's an enormous constituency of between 4 and 7 million voters. It tends to skew Democratic because it's a, you know, fairly cosmopolitan constituency. And 43% of those voters, according to the Overseas Vote Foundation, claim that they never received their absentee ballots or got them too late to file them.
Now, what state do these votes go into? If you're living in France, what state do you vote in?
Well, you vote in the state you come from.
Okay.
See, so there was a lot of, I got, as I say, a whole chapter on this. There was very suspicious interference with a huge new state-of-the-art website, the FVAP, Federal Voter Assistance Project, that was supposed to make registration from abroad easier. It unaccountably was blocked on 25 foreign servers from late August to late September, and all the explanations by the Pentagon as to why it was blocked were mutually contradictory. And then there was a lot of, you know, freelance kind of obstructionism.
You know, Mark, we've only got a few minutes left. I've got four people patiently waiting. Just one quick, and give a real short answer to this about the military vote. The caller suggests the military vote was rabidly pro-Bush.
That's false. In mid-October of last year, there was a poll, I believe AP published a piece, finding that a full third of the military vote was actually pro-Kerry. And there was a marked class bias. The officer corps tended to be Republican. The enlisted men tended to be Democratic.
Okay, back to the phone lines. We line one, Champagne. If you could be brief, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
If it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it probably is one. The people of America will probably end up with the democracy that they've chosen unless they're going to choose to be as agitated and aggravated about the stolen elections as they're slowly waking up to become as agitated about the war in Iraq. And I wish I had a question to ask you. You've done your research. It's extensive. Maybe I'm belying my ideology, but by God, you've crunched the numbers. You've looked at the anomalies. Do you have a proposal? What must be done by John Kerry and the rest of the members of the Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate?
Well, what must be done first, the first crucial first step is to get this story onto the national radar screen. It's been buried. It's been covered up from the beginning. Unless and until the American people see clearly what went down last year, there will be no impetus for the necessary reforms we need. And, you know, if we had more time, I could talk about what those are. But talking of policy choices is premature until the scandal finally resonates. So people listening to this show, constantly harass and pester your media outlets, constantly harass and pester your elected representatives, regardless of party, and tell them you will not tolerate their continuing to ignore this issue.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Chicago, thanks for your patience. Your brevity will be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention that I pretty much agree with what you've said, and as confirmation of your position, I suggest that people read the Robert Caro's 3-volume Life of Lyndon Johnson and Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty on the Bushes. And this pretty much confirms the methodology of the Bushes and the Texas Republicans in general, who control the Republican Party and the present administration. And they'll find confirmation of your position in those books.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, caller. Let's proceed ahead at full speed. Line 2, Charleston, you're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller, author of Fooled Again.
Yes. Again, a comment rather than a question. I know the system as it is cannot be fixed, so I'll only comment about the sameness of things. The only thing that's happened, the American population has grown larger. Therefore, more people are fooled. The democratic process should be called by its right name, republicanism. So long as money rules, there will be absolutely no real people in the Congress or in the presidency. Thank
you very much, caller. Now, Mark, we've done an amazing speed job through our callers. We're down to our last one.
Okay.
Line 3, Selena, you're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi. Great show you're doing. Regarding the Scooter Libby prosecution, he's been actually prosecuted for lying to the public, and I don't see why there's a reason that all these guys can't be prosecuted for all their lies they're telling us, because we know there's proof they told them. And also, I agree, it's not a good idea putting Kerry in. I've thought so all along, but it certainly be worth prosecuting all the crimes of voter fraud. And regarding aggressive decisions, we really have to get to the bottom of who made the actual egregious decisions. For instance, in Katrina, that they actually decided to let those people die. Not just didn't get there in time, they decided, no, we're not going to go yet.
Well,
thanks very,
I agree
very
with
much.
That.
Well, thank you, caller. Yeah, Mark, any comments on, we've really gone through 3 callers now, and we've got about a minute left. Do you have some summary comments?
I would say that money's contamination of the system is definitely a crucial problem. And what we're really talking about, you know, this is not a partisan issue. This is a civic issue. You know, I'm completely convinced of this. The parties have together completely failed the people in this important regard. And what we really need is not just certain policies. I mean, the Republic can't function if there isn't the proper civic spirit to let it function. You got to have what the framers called civic virtue. You have to be willing to subordinate your own desires and your own needs to the common good. So what I think we ultimately really need, and what we're really talking about here, is to reacquaint ourselves with our revolutionary tradition. We got to go back to Tom Paine. We got to go back to Thomas Jefferson. We have to understand checks and balances. We have to understand habeas corpus. We've let all this stuff slide.
Mark Crispin Miller, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means Tavis Smiley is about to push me out of the studio.
Okay.
Mark Crispin Miller, the author of Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One Too, Unless We Stop Them, just out by Basic Books. Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank John Anderson and Andrew Boyle for producing today's show, Brett Polson for being technical director. I'm Bob McChesney. See you next week.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-50s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 30s and light winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 40s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis.